Episode 1063, Seeing with Ian, Super Real.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I'm Ben DiBono. We're back. I have to say, so I'm still in the first part of this book. I think it's one of the most important books I've ever read. I mean, I'm not exaggerating.
Yes, because we didn't plan for this series to be virtually weekly.
Right.
But every week you're coming with something new you got from this book.
Yeah, like we've had three Seeing with Ian's now, which are directly from the book, but it's coming up in a lot of other contexts.
Came up in our business advice from
that
episode.
Right. I think didn't it just come up in Dune?
In Dune, yes.
Yeah. It's wild. I mean, this is it's tough to go to people and recommend, you know, you should pick up this giant 2,000 page book about neuroscience, but you probably should. It's pretty great. So tonight, you'd actually asked me a question after last time.
Yes.
And you'd asked me about, you know, because we were talking about all these delusions in the left hemisphere, right hemisphere. And by the way, if you don't understand all of that and you haven't listened to the other Seeing with Ian episodes, I'll give a little recap in a second. But really go back because you're going to be missing a lot if you haven't listened to those episodes.
Yeah, I know right where you're going with this. And in the middle of a previous episode, I wanted to ask you about a different delusion I'd heard of.
Right.
But, you know, you have an outline. I didn't want to totally derail you. So I knew I wanted to bring it up later.
Well, you know, and it's okay to derail me if you want to, because the way I think about outlines, the outlines are like a map. They're something to get you back to, but the conversation should ebb and flow and evolve beyond it. So I wouldn't worry about that. But you wanted to ask me about the Truman Show.
Right, because this is a favorite movie of mine.
Right.
And I'd heard people, like in our real world, sometimes feel like they're living in their own Truman Show.
Yes.
And so do you want to give the concept of the Truman Show?
Well, I think everybody's heard of the Truman Show.
Let's just say they hadn't.
So in the Truman Show, Harry S. Truman, the main character.
Okay, stop. Jim Carrey. This is before reality TV was huge, although it did exist at the time. I want to say 1998, 1999.
Right.
Is when the film came out. Jim Carrey plays a guy who, I'm wondering how much I want to spoil because I just love this movie so much. But as a baby, he was adopted by a corporation. And his whole life, since birth, he has been filmed, and that is being televised.
So everyone else is actors.
So, yes, he goes to school, he gets married, he has parents. None of these people are who he thinks they are, although they do live that life. Everybody on the show is actors.
Right. But he doesn't know it.
So he's the only person who's real on the whole show. And I've heard that...
Do you think there's a single person listening who hasn't seen the Truman Show?
You have to be careful. You just never know.
I think we know.
I love the Truman Show. This is one of my very favorites. And I didn't know if I wanted to admit this to you on the air, but one reason I'm intrigued by this is sometimes it crosses my mind. I think you can't, because we're self-centered humans, sometimes you do feel like the whole world is about you. And sometimes I do kind of feel like, maybe it has to do with a lot that you've been saying with simulation theory.
Yeah.
But some things just seem so unusual. It's like, am I being punked? Is this real? Is this world that I'm living in real? So I've sometimes felt like, and I feel embarrassed to admit it because it is a self-centered thing, but I sometimes feel like, is my life a Truman Show of sorts?
Right, or some variation there. I think it's a common thing to, you know, it's sort of the natural extension of solipsism. Like the only thing you can be sure is real is your own consciousness, mm-hmm. probably. I'm not even 100% sure you can be sure that's real.
Mm-hmm.
But you can be sure that you, whatever that means in the abstract, are experiencing something that you refer to as consciousness. So that's it. You know, and given that, and given the fact that reality is a complex thing, it calls into question. So anyway, you asked me this. Or said you wanted to ask me about it.
Well, I mean, what I said is you brought up different ways that people's reality or perception can change because of the state of their brains. And I wondered, as you've been reading this book, I can't remember what it's called.
The Matter with Things.
The Matter of with things. Have you read anything that relates to this Truman Show delusion?
So you asked me that, and then literally the next day I did.
The next day.
Yeah, so there you go. You're talking about simulation. So Ian was watching out for us, which is great. No, but so one of the things we're going to talk about then is, as we think about left hemisphere, right hemisphere differences, how does that impact our sense of reality? So that's one category, and I'll recap right hemisphere, left hemisphere in just a second. But underlying it is another question I think is really interesting to explore, which is, cue the Morpheus cliff, what is real? You know, and it's like, okay, that sounds like a nice, you know, platitude from somebody who's taken philosophy 101, but actually think about that for a second. You know, so when we talk about real, we tend to use that synonymously with the normal human experience of reality, which is to say that we know that there is a subjective nature to something. You know, if you and I were both witnesses to an event, were interviewed by the police, and you said in your interview, there was a guy there walking with a blue shirt on, and I came around and said, you know, there's a guy with a red shirt on, and we're referring to the same person. Like, okay, so our reality, our subjective reality, didn't line up, but certainly we're very close. Like, neither of us is saying there was an elephant walking down the road when there wasn't. So we can be relatively sure that when I refer to something and you refer to something, even if subjectively we may see different parts of it or may misinterpret parts of it, at least there's this sort of human baseline for we are experiencing reality. And so we define reality as synonymous with that. But is that true? Like, is that actually valid? And I'm not sure it is. Like, because we've talked about how complex reality is a lot. And so what if there are aspects of reality that are not made up of the standard human experience? And you say, oh, well, here we go. We're going to talk about clockwork elves again. Well, a little bit later, but not yet. Not yet. I'm actually talking about something more basic than that, which is in the same way where I could experience a delusion and see an elephant walking down the street when it's really just a man in a shirt, what if your brain was capable of going the other way? What if your brain was capable of seeing super reality? And I'm not talking about the clockwork elves yet. I'll give the drugs warning before I start talking about DMT in a little bit. Okay, so what I'm suggesting is, if we all accept the fact that your brain can go one way with reality, delusion, right? We all agree the brain is capable of seeing things that are not there. Is the opposite true too? And the answer turns out to be, yeah, actually. And we can prove it. So left hemisphere, right hemisphere, quick recap for those who just need a refresher or haven't heard the previous scene with Ian episodes, please go listen to them. At least the first one. So you're caught up on this. But now I'm going to butcher this. So we talked about in What the Facts, directional accuracy. I'm going to give you a directionally accurate summary that is not pinpoint accuracy. Okay. So directionally accurate, your left hemisphere and right hemisphere do different things. You know, it's not the pop culture thing where the left hemisphere is facts and logic and the right hemisphere is emotion. That's not it at all. The left hemisphere is very detail focused. It's very interested in the particulars. It's not as interested in the bigger picture. The right hemisphere is about relationships between things. It's about that bigger picture. The right hemisphere is in touch with reality as it actually is. The left hemisphere is in touch with this sort of artificial reality where it constructs the individual pieces into its own thing. You know, one of the images that we talked about in the very first episode that I've come back to again and again when I explain this concept to people is that one where you see the letter H made up of tiny little twos, mm-hmm. right? So imagine H, but not written with straight lines, but written made out of tiny little twos. Somebody with right hemisphere damage, so their right hemisphere isn't working, they see all the twos. So somebody in that case recreates the image and they just draw a bunch of random twos on there. They see all the details. Somebody with their left hemisphere damaged draws an H, no twos. They see the big picture, not the little details. Directionally accurate idea of what we're getting at. So the question then becomes, what happens to your sense of reality, or what can happen to your sense of reality when your left hemisphere or right hemisphere suffers damage. So let's start with right hemisphere damage, which is our Truman Show scenario. So there's a couple of things with this. And Ian says, a diminished sense of reality is a very common experience in schizophrenia, a syndrome that, as I've suggested, closely resembles aspects of a right hemisphere deficit syndrome. It can be so pervasive that patients believe that nothing is real, all is play acting. In hospital, patients often believe that the doctors and nurses are actors, the ward is a stage set, everything a representation of reality, not reality itself. So there you go. It's a very common thing. By the way, if you want a good movie recommendation on schizophrenia, there's a great movie called Clean Shaven. And what's phenomenal about this movie is that the main character has schizophrenia, or at least a similar disease. It's been a while since I watched it. But the camera techniques and the use of sound and everything are, the movie is designed to simulate what it's like inside of this guy's head. So it's a very unique viewing experience of what his reality is like. Fascinating movie. Breaks every single rule for how to frame scenes and design a story and everything, but it does it for a very intentional purpose. It's highly recommended. So there's a term for this, Capgras syndrome, or Capgras syndrome. I think it's a French guy it's named after. And I'm actually going to read from one of our favorite sources, Wikipedia, here, because Capgras delusion, as the Wikipedia does, it has a few different case studies on it that are kind of interesting. So I'll read a couple of these. Mrs. D, a 74-year-old married housewife recently discharged from a local hospital after her first psychiatric admission, presented our facility for a second opinion. At the time of her admission earlier in the year, she had accepted the diagnosis of atypical psychosis because of her belief that her husband had been replaced by another unrelated man. She refused to sleep with the imposter, locked her bedroom and door at night, asked her son for a gun, and finally fought the police when attempts were made to hospitalize her. At times, she believed her husband was her long-deceased father. She easily recognized other family members and would misidentify her husband only. Which is just wild. So there's all sorts of variations on this. Like, you know, your reality seems less real. You know, you begin to believe that everybody is involved, you know, is an actor. It's kind of the Truman Show thing, or just like this, where you believe one person has been replaced. But to go off on a bit of a tangent on this, I assume that when you're talking about Truman Show feelings, you're not talking about that.
Right. No.
But I've experienced senses of unreality too.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give you one from Saturday. So Saturday, I did my annual Century 100-mile bike ride. And unfortunately, about 10 miles into it, it began to rain. And began to rain quite hard. And in fact, there was a lot of lightning, which, by the way, you know, if that sounds dangerous, it's not. What you do is you find a taller biker and bike behind that person. Perfectly safe. So, you know, just a tip to say, because you want to stay safe out there. Yeah. You don't want to get zapped.
We want to keep our listeners safe.
Exactly. So that's what you do. So anyway, my helmet, though, my bike helmet has a visor on it. So it's like this, because I don't wear sunglasses, though most people would, because when you're biking, it's like you don't just want the wind blowing in your face for miles and hours and hours. It's uncomfortable. So I have a visor on. Well, as you can imagine, as you're biking, this visor is just like smothered in rain, and it's impossible to clear because my bike gloves are soaking wet, so you try and wipe it and it just makes it worse. So like, I could barely see, you know, I could see well enough to navigate, but you couldn't see very well. And so there was a point in the ride where I'm out there biking, I can't see, and I'm tired. The whole thing's bizarre because it's pouring rain. I'm in the middle of a thunderstorm. I would not normally be biking in these conditions. And it was like, in that moment, the whole thing just didn't feel real.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I had a moment where I thought to myself, I'm pretty sure this is actually happening, but it felt very dreamlike, very surreal there, because it was like my senses were impaired. I could see, but not, kind of like you would in a dream.
Yeah.
Like, you can see, but not really.
Yeah.
Like, you're navigating, but things aren't right. Like, it was like that. And so I very much had that sense of unreality there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know what that means as far as, like, the hemispheres of your brain. But it wouldn't surprise me if there's something where your right hemisphere is more dependent on, and this is pure speculation on my part, but like your right hemisphere is more dependent on stimuli that I wasn't getting in that moment. You know, if to go even further on my speculation, I'm not remotely qualified to do this, but it's like if the right hemisphere is dependent on big picture, well, I literally can't see the big picture. You know, I can only see bits and pieces. I can only feel where I'm at on my bike, but the big picture is just gone.
So do you think how you could see started to detach you from reality?
I mean, just the whole thing was, you know, the whole thing, it was very divorced from how I normally feel on my bike. You know, because you're focused on a lot of different things. You know, what's up ahead? How fast am I going? What's the mileage? You know, all of these different things. Am I hydrating? And here it's just, you know, suddenly you're in such different circumstances, but doing something that you're used to, which again is very dreamlike. Mm-hmm. Like I'm doing something familiar, but not where I would normally do it. Yeah, so the whole thing was very surreal for about a 10-mile stretch there, which thankfully cleared up later in the day. But you know, I experienced that feeling of this doesn't feel real right now.
Yeah.
It was very bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah, I think mine, trying to think back, I haven't felt like it recently, but I remember in the past, I don't know how to put it. Now that we're talking about it, now that we've talked so much about simulation stuff and just finding coincidences, I think it more was a matter of I was starting to see coincidences as maybe more than coincidences, and then I'm wondering, well, what's really happening here?
See, this is where we have to do my simulation evidence rating episode sometime soon.
We haven't told the listeners about this.
No, but it's modified from what I told you.
Oh, do you want to tease it now, or do you want to do an episode about it?
Well, so I'm gathering evidence for the simulation, but not in the way that... Like what I first proposed to you is a flawed system, and I'll explain why. I have a refined system.
Let's just do a different episode about
Different episode, but I'm going to teach you how to track evidence for the simulation, and part of it is actually that. Like, I started to think, for fun, I was thinking through, how do you do this without going insane? Because the danger is that you start to see the simulation everywhere and you go insane. So it's like, how do you avoid that? Well, I came up with a system that I think
to keep
accomplishes
us safe.
That.
Yeah, it wants to be safe.
So you got
to
stay safe. Like, you know, you don't want to just hike out looking for evidence for the simulation because you might go insane.
Yeah.
Like, kind of literally, like, I'm not saying we were actually going to go insane from this idea, but kind of literally, you know, I've been watching the show The Rehearsal on HBO, which is fantastic. Actually, ties into a lot of this because it has a very Truman Show vibe to
it. Really?
To
I haven't watched it yet.
Oh, you should.
I will.
It's incredible. But he has a guy on the second episode who's very into numerology, and he's, like, just driving. He's like, look, it says 88 on the, you know, on the stereo. You know, it's just like he's got all these numbers, and he keeps going on about it. And so, you know, the Reddit forum and everything for The Rehearsal has just been talking about how crazy this guy is, and it's like, okay, you know, we don't want to wind up as him because he's seen this everywhere. So it's like, how do you track things? Because when you start looking for coincidences, you will see them everywhere. So how do you do that and not turn into Robin from The Rehearsal? Like, that was the goal. So I came up with a system for that.
So in a future episode, we'll be back with that.
Yes. All right. So one other thing before we flip to the other side and start talking about super reality. Deja vu kind of falls into this category, too. So Ian says, worth including here is the phenomenon of deja vu as an anomalous experience of reality. Abnormal electrical activity in the right hemisphere should lead to an excess of the feeling of unique familiarity, or its loss altogether, depending on whether the result is exaggeration or diminution of the right hemisphere's characteristic mode of being. Yes, it's deja vu all over again, or its converse, jamais vu, never before seen. Indeed, both of these phenomena usually result from right hemisphere disturbance.
That's interesting, because I was just going to ask you, I think everybody has experienced deja vu to some extent.
All the time.
Yeah. But if you're a person who is experiencing it all the time...
I didn't mean I literally experience it all the time.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, everybody from time to time experiences this. But let's say daily or weekly this is happening to somebody. Does that indicate they have some sort of brain damage?
It could, I guess. Again, I'm speculating. Yeah. I'm not qualified to answer that question. But it seems like it.
Okay.
Or at least something's going on.
Hmm. Okay.
All right.
How often would you say you have deja vu? Now that we're talking about it, I would say almost even once a month is too much.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say not several times a year.
Yeah. It happens to me, but not
It is very disconcerting when it happens. Like, it I don't like it.
Really?
Yeah, I dislike the feeling of deja vu.
Yeah, for me, it like, moves me sometimes. Like, I kind of, like, I feel, okay, I know that this is not true, but I feel like it's a bigger thing than it actually is.
Right, right. No,
like,
it feels very significant.
Like, it makes me feel connected to that moment and why. Like, where did I have this moment before? Am I reliving something? Did right. I dream about this? Are we touching the borders of a parallel universe?
Right.
I mean, these are
explanations. Silly, but that's how it feels yeah. in the moment.
I know, and these are all explanations that sci-fi has given us. I don't know what deja vu actually is. Right. It moves me in some way where I feel very connected to that moment, trying to figure out why am I feeling this.
Yeah.
I liked how he put it. This unique, what did he say? A unique sensation of...
I don't know. How did he put it? I don't know.
All right, well.
Unique familiarity.
Yeah, unique familiarity. I like that.
So let's go the other way. So that's what happens when your right hemisphere gets messed up. What about your sense of reality on the other side? Because, well, let's just read what he has to say. In the sequence of perioperative cases referred to earlier, Mullen and Penfield described two people who experienced what the authors call illusions of greater awareness or a heightened sense of reality. Both had right hemisphere lesions. In one case, it appeared to involve paroxysmal excitation of the right hemisphere, and in fact, it is recorded that artificial stimulation at operation of the affected area gave rise to the patient to the sense of intensified awareness, making the interpretation of this case more straightforward. By stimulating the right hemisphere, the patient had a heightened sense of smells, sounds, visible objects, and pressures. He called it new awareness, or whatever he was experiencing, whether it was his own backyard or simply cigarette smoke. So I'll tell you where my brain went with a corollary on this. At the end of Chronicles of Narnia, when they go through the doorway, they enter into the new Narnia.
Yeah.
And everything's the same, but it's more so.
And better.
Better. Exactly. That seems to be what they're describing here. It's that type of experience.
Yeah. I like how they put it, that the worlds are similar, but the world they just left is a shadow of yes. this greater world.
Exactly.
And of course, a lot of people think that that's what the new heavens and the new world
right,
will be
right.
like.
But you think about, like, what would that be like? Well, people are experiencing something at least kind of like that for real. So he goes on. In one of these cases reported by Howard Cushing in 1922, there was an exaggeration of his special sense impressions, i.e. flowers become extraordinarily beautiful, odors are intensified, his vision appears to be remarkably keen, so that objects seem to be increased in size. This involved a glioma of the left temporal lobe and a consequent right-sided visual field defect. In the other case reported by MacDonald Crickley in 1951, he states that the side of the lesion was unverified, although he thought it was more likely to be left-sided. During what sound clinically like complex partial seizures, one of the chessmen, his opponent's knight, for about half a minute seemed distorted. The pieces seemed to stand out more clearly, and the carving seemed deeper and more attractive. And finally, we have a quote from somebody who's experiencing this. I remember my attention to the tiny birds that were busy flitting among the dense of dark green bushes in front of the car. It was like I was seeing them in a new light, and on another occasion I felt fantastic seeing the trees in the sunshine. Like my experience of watching the birds, I felt that I was seeing them through different, more seeing eyes. So that type of thing fascinates me. Like, that's actually wild.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's different than being moved by nature.
Right.
Like, I was out for a run recently, and the sky was beautiful, the clouds, the sun, I mean, everything. Right. I just kind of, again, I was moved by just what I was seeing, but I don't feel like I was seeing it in a different way. I was just seeing a good day.
Or it's like, maybe it's like that, what we experience in those moments, it does sound like that, but more so, mm-hmm. like more holistic, more mm-hmm. profound.
Like, I felt closer to God.
Right.
Just on that run and from what I was seeing. And I think you might be heading this way, but do you feel like this has anything to do with, well?
I'm going to run out onto my limb in just a minute. We're going to leave Ian behind in a minute, and I'll make it clear that we're doing so because I don't want him saddled with my reckless speculation. But just give me a minute. We'll get there.
Okay.
Because there's a little bit more, which is brain damage curing you. of things. Two cases. A patient with borderline personality disorder marked by severe self-mutilation, sense of futility, and tendency to manipulate others ceased to exhibit the symptoms after a left frontotemporal injury sustained in a suicide attempt. So, suicidal, horrible tendencies, brain damage, cured. Okay, that's wild.
Well, wait a second. I've been studying near-death experiences lately, and if they had an encounter with God in that moment, that could have been what changed them. But
that's not... Okay. There's no reference to a near-death experience here. This is like they tried to kill themselves, damage their brain, and it cured that self-mutilation, manipulation of others, and suicidal attempts.
I should say, I'm not totally all in on near-death experiences, but I have been very interested in hearing more stories.
We should do an episode on them because I have thoughts.
Okay, let's do it.
But then people with left hemisphere damage, this one just is wild to me, can become human lie detectors. Here, too, being less in touch with reality as it is perceived, less in touch with the body and the implicit jump into conclusions and being unable to shift mindset is not a good start. But there are other essential factors in having a solid understanding of human reality, which the left hemisphere seems to not get, the emotional impact of human behavior. Oliver Sacks writes that one cannot lie to an aphasiac, and I forget the exact definition of aphasiac, A-P-H-A-S-I-A-C, but it's something to do with losing control of language. So, like, you know, the left hemisphere controls more with reading and words.
Yeah, loss of ability to understand or express speech caused by brain damage.
Such a patient may not understand language, and so is not deceived by it, but instead grasps with infallible precision the totally spontaneous, involuntary expressiveness which can never be simulated or faked, as words alone can too easily. In the film The Divided Brain, Jill Bolt Taylor even suggests that people with left hemisphere strokes should be employed as lie detectors. So the idea here is that you get the left hemisphere out of the way, and this whole world opens up. So now I'm going to run out onto my limb.
All right, so no more. This is not Ian.
This is me.
These are not his thoughts. Here we go, Ben.
So the left hemisphere, like, language skills are tremendous. You know, we both like to read, and you know, we both have all of, you know, we're doing a podcast which involves language skills. We're fans. But does it seem like maybe there's a trade-off between that, where our language skills and that whole part of our brain blocks us from this heightened sense of reality? Okay? So this, because we have this, there's a trade-off. Like, because we have this, we've now lost that.
But what have we lost?
Well, that's an interesting question. We'd start with what we just described in concrete terms, and we'll run out on the limb, is heightened sense of reality. Whatever that happens to mean, you know, this sort of Narnia as it ought to be experience, the human lie detector thing is fascinating. Like, imagine that. Like actually think about what that claim is there for a second. Oh, can you tell if somebody's lying? Well, and we're not talking about somebody who's trained in it. We're talking about somebody with brain damage. And now they're able to tell somebody's lying. It's like this thing that's a benefit here is also has a trade-off to it. It has a cost to it. The cost is that you don't get to do that, or at least most of us. Mm-hmm. But let's keep going a bit, because it seems like what we're describing is, you know, also... It's also related to other things we've discussed. Drugs, for instance. So thinking about the, like, I thought about Narnia with this hyperreal. The other thing I thought of was the movie Midsommar. Hmm. So in Midsommar, and I won't, this isn't a spoiler for anything, but hallucinogens are used throughout that film, both willingly and not willingly. And there are several subjective moments in the film where, like, you just see, you know, you'll see flowers and it looks like they're breathing. It looks like they're alive. I mean, I know flowers are alive, but in a more profound, animalistic way than they normally would. And there's some great shots in that movie that, like, put you into that mindset and things feel alive in a way that they're not. Similarly, let's say that a DMT trip actually does something, meaning that it's not hallucinogenic, but it, or at least not only, you know, we don't want to be reductionistic here, but it to some degree puts you in contact with other parts of reality. Isn't that in a sense being done by impairing other parts of your mind? It is, because you're not experiencing this. Like, you know, if you take drugs right now, you take DMT, you're in this room, but you're no longer experiencing it. You trade that off for this. If it's real in some sense, again, I'm not recommending drugs. I'm against drugs, but I'm fascinated by them.
By their effects.
Yeah. And I don't think those are mutually exclusive positions. Well, they can't be because I hold them. You know, even if they're, you could argue they're contradictory, but I hold both of those positions. I think DMT is fascinating. I think psychedelics are fascinating, and I don't recommend you take them, and I have never taken them, and I have no plans to ever take them, so I'm not recommending anything there. But nevertheless, if we're going to have an eye-open view of reality, we need to be willing to discuss those things honestly. Like, because is there something there? And it's okay to have the position no, but it's not okay to have the position no because you don't like drugs. Okay, we don't like drugs. But is something happening there? If it is, it seems a lot like what we're describing here. But then it also comes down to, you know, transcendent experience. Like it takes something like, you know, visions in the Bible, you know, Ezekiel, you know, Isaiah, when he sees the throne of God. It's like the transcendent feels a lot like this too. It is that which is beyond words. You know, the things that the left hemisphere does well will not help you when you are in the presence of the transcendent. I've mentioned this story a number of times of Aquinas writes the Summa, and then at the end of his life, he has a vision of God, and he says, everything I've written is straw. It's like, well, the Summa is a very left hemisphere book, you know, and I don't say that as a negative thing. Like, it is categorizing, it is logical, it's, of course, filled with words, you know, it's that, it's, you know, this attempt to understand, you know, and it's too simplistic to call it a left hemisphere book, but let's just roll with that for a second. And then this vision Aquinas has is like so far beyond that, it's so real beyond real that everything that he's accomplished here feels like nothing. You know, there's something there. And then I started to think about art. And specifically, art that really engages the right hemisphere. Two movies in particular. The first one, 2001. There's no dialogue. Okay, so that's a hard hurdle for people to get over. Like, you know, when you and I both started, like, neither of us liked 2001 the first time we watched it. But now it's my favorite movie, but it's like, why? You know, why is that such a hurdle? Well, we want to engage with things in this sort of left hemisphere way. Well, let's put on, again, ballpark accuracy, but let's look at something like 2001 from the Ian McGilchrist perspective. What's going on there? Well, if you try and engage 2001 with your left hemisphere, you fail. The movie sucks because there's just monkeys running around.
At the beginning.
Yeah. But even throughout the movie, there's hardly any dialogue in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's like nothing for your left hemisphere to latch onto in that movie. And then the right hemisphere, it's like this bigger picture, this flow, this connection, that it becomes this profound experience, really, really profound experience. The other film I was thinking of is Tree of Life. Oh, it's like, yeah, there's this story here. We don't really care about the story. I mean, we do, but the point of the story is to get you into the space where you can experience the transcendent, which is what Tree of Life does. And it becomes this profound meditation on that. It's like, okay, so is art a way to simulate the same type of thing, the same hyper reality, the same experience of the super real? Well, it sure seems like it. You know, and then I started to think about, because Ian McGilchrist has talked about this a little bit, I have a feeling he's going to come back to it more, but that music is a very right hemisphere thing. So I was thinking about this last night because I was listening to Akira the Don. Have you heard of Akira the Don?
No, I have not.
So he's great. Like, everybody go to Spotify and check him out. So what he does is he takes clips from people like Jordan Peterson or Scott Adams or Jocko Willink, and he puts them to music. And it's like, you need to go listen to this. You can't just hear me describe it because it doesn't make sense when you describe it. But when you actually listen to it, it's like these profound truths and ideas and these big ideas that these guys are talking about. Like, I've listened to these same lectures, and then you listen to it with music. Like, he did the Litany of Fear from Dune.
Oh, how do you spell it?
Akira, A-K-I-R-A, the Don, as in Don Corleone.
All right, found it.
Yeah, it's profound. Like, it's really, really profound, and it gets to you in the same type of way, like, in a different way, but the same type of way that something like a 2001 or Tree of Life does. So it's like, well, what's going on there? Okay, so if part of what's going on is that art and the transcendent are engaging us at the level of the super real. And the super real is what I'm describing. It's my blanket term for whatever this is when we talk about this heightened sense of reality. Whatever this is that is true in the DMT trips. Maybe it's zero there, but whatever it is. The reality that Ari Aster's trying to convey in Midsommar and C.S. Lewis is conveying at the end of Narnia. And we're experiencing when we watch something like 2001 and you get when you listen to an Akira the Don and Isaiah's experiencing whatever the common thread there of that experience of reality. And there's something there. That's what I'm calling super real. Okay, so there's something profoundly human about that. And then I finally come back to one of my old hobby horses, which is, why do most sermons suck? Because they do. Like, what do most sermons do? Well, they want you to have a takeaway. Like, what's the one common thing we can say about all those experiences is that you cannot reduce them to a takeaway. And it seems to me, again, this has been on a limb, that the takeaway is a profoundly flawed attempt to take the right hemisphere experience of the super real and reduce it to something that the left hemisphere can feel good about. And that kind of sucks. I'm not saying that there isn't any such thing as a lesson. Like, clearly there's lessons, you know, but it's like the Book of Job. You know, you read the Book of Job and you want a takeaway. The takeaway of the Book of Job is that you don't get one. Like, that's actually the point. Like, Job is asking for a takeaway. He's asking for the sermon takeaway for that whole book, and God gets up and yells at him instead. Like, that's it. The end. You don't get any answers. That's why I love the Book of Job. Like, I think Job is such a profound work because of that.
Is it your favorite book of the Bible?
I don't know. You know, it's one of them. You know, it's definitely up there. I like it more than Leviticus, for instance. But, you know, it's so profound. And it's like every single sermon, I shouldn't say every, I'm being too reductionistic, but so many sermons, like, it's a common thing. You got to get to the takeaway. You send people out with their little goodie bag of lessons, and they go and forget them because there's nothing interesting about that. Like, what if instead you saw the Bible in a Protestant context, or the Mass as it's when it's properly done, as this, as the gateway to the transcendence? The Mass, when it's properly done, is this. It's in this category.
So in the Catholic Church, do the priests not have a takeaway?
I'm sure they do. Like, there's a lot of bad homilies. Thankfully, we have the benefit of our homilies are short. You know, they are not the main point. So I'm not going to excuse a lot of horrible Catholic preaching, but at least it's short, and at least it's not the main thing, right? The main thing's the Eucharist.
How long is a homily?
10 minutes. Oh, yeah. Like, we had a visiting priest there yesterday, and he was 80-something years old.
How long did he talk for?
Too long.
Like, you know, did he talk for?
I think it was probably 15. It was like a homily and a half.
15 minutes is too much for you.
Yeah.
I was going to ask something about this. So you said like the main event is the Eucharist. So is what it ends with?
Yes.
Okay. So
Catholic Mass
leads up to that. Okay.
Yeah. So it's this profound profoundly transcendent moment when it's done right, which a lot of Catholic masses are done poorly. So, but the Eucharist is still a transcendent event. So anyway, that's what I'm thinking about with this. I don't have a takeaway because this is such a big idea, but there is something really profound here, that there is this hyper reality out there. And again, I'm not endorsing drugs. You know, I am endorsing great art, but it's like, what if part of what it means to be human is to get in touch with that, whatever that is? And what if things like art, religion, God are all of our, are some of our gateways into that? And then what does it mean when we've taken those things and we've cheapened them? We've reduced it to the 3-point sermon. We've made it banal. You know, we've sold it to Disney, which, yeah, I'm actually kind of serious there. It's like you sell it to them and it's just this cheap crap when it ought to be part of the hyper real, you know, profound idea. So anyway, that's what I've got for Seeing with Ian this week.
Oh, I like it. Wow. Super real.
Super real.
So this is a term you made up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listeners, let us know if you've experienced the super real, and how did you get there? Feedback at thesapphicchristian.com.
I mean, I hope you have, but...
Can you think of an experience where you've had the, or you've experienced...
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that, like, you know, not in the same, exactly the same way, but, like, profound experiences of art, for example, have definitely done that. I think profound religious experiences do that. You know, that's... the point. And it's why we should go do those things, or at least a reason we should go do those things.
All right, listeners, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono.
And we're the Sapphic Christian, signing off.
Right, goodbye.